Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right. Welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding about their great careers and also about the history of bodybuilding. And today we have another throwback episode. This is coming from January of 2015 when I just started doing the interviews with some of the old school bodybuilders. And this one is with the legendary Mike Katz. And Mike, of course, was featured in the movie and also the book Pumping Iron. He is one of the best well-known bodybuilders in the 1970s. He won the 1970 IFBB Mr. America, and he also won the IFBB Mr. World, beating out Ken Waller. And then he was featured, as I said, in the book Pumping Iron, where they covered the 1972 IFBB Mr. Universe, which was held in Baghdad, Iraq. And Mike was a big part of that book, along with Ed Corney. And then, of course, if you've seen the movie Pumping Iron, and who hasn't seen the movie Pumping Iron, Mike was featured as a really big part of that movie in the beginning of the movie, his rivalry with Ken Waller when he competed in the Mr. Universe contest in 1975. So we got a great old school interview here with Mike Katz, and we're going to talk about his whole bodybuilding career, including some of the competitions that he competed in. And of course, he was a training partner of Arnold Schwarzenegger for many times. So he's got some great stories about Arnold and about Sergio Oliva, and you're really going to love this interview. We also talk about Mike's football career, because Mike played with the New York Jets before he got into competitive bodybuilding. So we talk a lot about that as well. So that interview will be coming up in a minute. I do want to mention, of course, that we are brought to you by Old School Labs, our sponsor. And I have been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner, Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 and 2018 Classic Physique Olympia champion, and he's also the 2018 Classic Physique Arnold Classic champion. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banoot and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 when you go on their website, oldschoollabs.com, and you will get a 12% discount off your order. Or if you go to amazon.com, you can also order your purchase there. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right. Well, happy December. We are now in the last month of 2018. This year has gone by so fast, and we actually missed our show last week because I was out of town. I was in the U.S. Virgin Islands in St. Croix and St. Thomas, and I was giving some seminars out there for the police department for St. Croix and St. Thomas. So that was really a lot of fun, and I had a great trip. It was a real fast trip. I left work on Sunday afternoon, and I took a plane out Sunday night, and I flew to Miami and then flew to St. Croix and stayed in a hotel out there. And then Monday morning, I went out to the police department out there, and I gave a seminar for the police department. Right after that, I took another plane over to St. Thomas. And then on Tuesday morning, I did a seminar. I think it was actually at the fire department in St. Thomas, and it was open to the public. It was a free seminar. And it wasn't really a bodybuilding seminar. It was more just about fitness and how people can change their bodies by using the bodybuilding lifestyle, which is weight training and some cardio exercise and, of course, the right diet. And this is the islands, the Virgin Islands. So natives there follow kind of a high-carb diet, a lot of rice. And some people are overweight because they really don't know about nutrition. And they were a little skeptical when I started talking about what I ate. But I think I kind of won everybody over at the end. So it really went well. And I think they're going to have me back in January. So I would love to go back there. They set me up at this beautiful, beautiful villa in St. Thomas in the mountains. And it was just amazing. If you're friends with me on Facebook, I posted some pictures of it. I was right above the ocean, and God, it was just an amazing view. I wish I could have spent more time out there, but I really only was there a couple hours before I had to go to the seminar, and then I just went right to the airport from there. So, but it was a great trip and met some really good people, so I hope I can come back soon. I'm trying to do more seminars on just fitness and bodybuilding and all different subjects, and my goal is to do at least 2 seminars a month, which I've been doing for the last couple of months. So that's going to be my goal as I continue on to 2019. And speaking of goals, I have my last photo shoot coming up in only a couple of days. I'm recording this podcast on Sunday, and my last photo shoot is going to be on Tuesday, December 4th, and that will be with criticalbench.com, and they are out in Clearwater, Florida, which is only about 20 minutes away from me. And they have their headquarters out there. So I'm heading out there on Tuesday morning, and we're going to do a photo shoot, some videos. And I really feel like this is the best I looked right now. I think I peaked for my third photo shoot. I think you just have to stay on the diet for a while, especially when I haven't been lean in like 2 years. And I got really big this year. I got up to 230, so it took me a while to come down. And I think now finally I hit my peak. The skin is really tight on my lower abs. I'm real vascular. I'm full. And my weight was about 197 this morning, so I'm close to 200 pounds. So it was really a great practice for next year in 2019 when I plan on competing again. I think I'm going to shoot for the MPC Florida State and the Mass Bodybuilding, which will be in August. So I'll have about, I think, like 7 months of the off season, which will start next week. You know, I'll do like my deload week this week right after my photo shoot, go light all week. And then I'll start my first power cycle next week. I'll do that MP6 workout that I've been doing for the last few years. If you want to check out how that MP6 workout works, you can purchase the book from me if you want. Just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, or you can go to amazon.com and purchase it there. And I've been following this religiously for the last couple of years, and it's really, really helped to add more size and make my workouts more interesting. So that is where I'm at. And I'm really excited. I'm really pumped up. I'm really motivated. I can't believe how psyched up I am getting in shape for this photo shoot. So if you guys are out there and haven't been in shape for a while, I recommend it. Absolutely. I mean, start your diet, get in shape, do it. Just take some photos or do it for a contest or whatever goal you want to come up with. And it really will motivate you to push yourself harder. And then, like with myself, once I got into this shape, I am more psyched up now than ever to do it again. So I've got my off season all planned. I'm going to stay a little bit leaner, train heavier, make improvements on my weak points. I was able to see what my body looks like being really ripped. So, you know, you're able to see your strong points, your weak points. So I've got my goals all set up, and I'm really psyched up for 2019. So I'm really, really happy with all the way all this went, and I'm looking forward to doing my last photo shoot on Tuesday. All right. In other news, we do have a new interview coming up this week with Manuel Terry. And for those who are not around in the 1970s, Manuel Terry was one of the best amateur bodybuilders in the 1970s. He really hit his peak in 1977 when he competed in the AAU Mr. America, and he won the tall class that year. And Manuel just had an amazing physique. He really didn't compete that long in bodybuilding. But the years that he was in bodybuilding, he presented a physique that was both massive and very aesthetic. So Manuel actually quit bodybuilding to go into the movies, and he started a career as a stuntman in the movies. And I believe one of his first jobs was working with Lou Ferrigno on the Incredible Hulk TV series. And Manuel is still, to this day in 2018, he is still working as a stuntman in the movies. So I can't wait to talk to him and find out about his actual career, I guess, in the movies. Because I'm a big movie buff myself, so that should be really interesting. And I also, of course, want to talk to him about his bodybuilding career, because he was in some really great bodybuilding shows in the 1970s. I also heard back today, actually, from Barry DeMay, who, if you've been following Barry on Instagram or on Facebook, he is in phenomenal shape. Barry's about a year older than me. I think he's like 56, and I don't know why, but he is really motivated now to get in great shape. And he's dieted down. He looks amazing. In fact, I saw this great picture on Facebook yesterday with him and Rich Gaspari, because Barry was in the United States visiting Rich. And I believe they were at the Montieri Brothers gym, powerhouse gym out in Connecticut. And they were training out there. and there was a picture of Barry posing in the mirror, and Richie was watching him. And I was like, wow, it's just a great, great picture. It really made me smile because you got these two great bodybuilders from the 1980s that I grew up watching and reading about in the magazines. And here they are like 30 years later, and they're still at it. They're still in the gym. They're still passionate about bodybuilding. So that was so awesome to see. And there's so many of these guys from the 1980s that are still looking good and still training hard. So that was really such a great era. But anyways, Barry emailed me back today, and he said he is in the process of starting his supplement line. And he said once that is up and running, which should be early next year, he is going to call me and we'll do an interview for the Bodybuilding Legends show and the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And he said I'll be the first on his list because I have been after him for a couple of years now to do this interview. So that was great news. I also heard from Rory Liedelmeyer last week, and Rory said he also is interested in doing the interview. I think we're going to do it on Skype, so we'll make it a video interview like I just did with Lee Labrada. So I'm hoping to hear again from Rory. I'll keep bugging him. I also heard from Samir, and Samir is still in the process of setting up his Skype. So once he gets that set up, we will do our interview. We've been waiting for years for that. You just got to be persistent with these guys and keep going after them, which I am. So, and I also talked to Phil Williams because I had such a great interview with Phil. I told him I wanted to interview him again, and I thought maybe we could interview him about his bodybuilding career, about all the competitions he went in, like the 84 MPC USA where he beat Lee Labrada, and then, of course, the 85 MPC Nationals, and then the 88 Chicago Pro. So I thought it would be interesting if we just talked about the competitions that he was in that he won, and about his preparation and the guys he trained with and then the guys he competed with on stage. And I thought that would be a great interview because Phil was really, a lot of people really liked that interview, including myself, because he's so down to earth and he got some great stories. So I thought that would be great to revisit with Phil Williams. So hopefully we can do that sometime this month in December. All right. I did have a couple emails this last week, right after our Franco Santarello interview. This one was from Mike Testani from Canada. Mike said, "Hi, John. As a bodybuilding historian myself, I absolutely love your show. I love the interview with Franco Santoriello. I actually went to train with Franco for a few months in Jersey when he was getting ready for the Nationals. What a great guy." All right. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for listening to the show. I got another email here from Nicholas Daver. And Nicholas said, "Hi, my name is Nicholas Daver. I'm 56 years old. I live in Stockholm, Sweden. I would just like to thank you for all the wonderful interviews on your podcast. It's wonderful to hear from the old legends of the sport, and you're doing a wonderful job bringing out their memories and recollections. I just read your book, Bodybuilding Legends and Heroes Part 1, and I thought it was a wonderful read, bringing back so many memories. I got in love with the sport of bodybuilding in 1978, and I became, just like yourself, an avid reader of all the American muscle magazines. I still remember with fondness my first year of training when I ordered my countryman Andreas Colling's training courses and I gained 10 kilos of muscle in a year. I was starving for muscles. I would love to hear interviews with some of the heroes from those days and the days of the bodybuilding golden years. Tony Pearson, how I would love to hear his interpretation of the 1978 Mr. America. Andreas Colling, just a wealth of information on training and nutrition and the golden years of bodybuilding. Joe Bucci with his tremendous arms, Bill Pearl, the longevity king, Pat Neve, what a powerful upper body, Ellington Darden, a Nautilus experience and his own bodybuilding career, Tim Belknap, is he still alive, Rachel McLish, Don Peters, Vince Gironda was his trainer, Bob Paris, what an intelligent man, and many more. There's a wealth of experience and knowledge out there, and you're so good at sharing that through your interviews. Regards, Nicholas Daver from Stockholm, Sweden." Wow, a lot of great suggestions there. I did reach out to Andreas Colling. I don't think he responded, so I'll keep trying him. Tony Pearson is a guy I've been trying for years, literally years, to interview, and he does not ever respond to my emails, so I don't know. I guess he's just not interested in doing an interview. Joe Bucci, I would love to interview Joe Bucci. I did meet him a couple times before in the 90s, and he had that he was running that Marina Pacific Hotel, which was right by Gold's Gym in Venice. So I'm sure he's got some great stories, but I don't know how to get a hold of Joe. I can try and look for him on Facebook. If anybody has any information on where Joe is, please email that to me at naturalolympia@gmail.com and I'll get a hold of him. Bill Pearl, I don't think is going to do any interviews anymore. He is unfortunately going through Parkinson's disease. And I mean, he's still healthy. He's 88 years old now, but I don't think he would be interested in doing an interview. Pat Neve, I'm supposed to interview Pat soon. He just went through neck surgery and he's still recovering. So I know Pat has really been going through a hard time with that. But I just did email him again last week, and Pat said about another week or two and he'll be ready for an interview. So that one should be coming up soon. Ellington Darden, I don't know where I could reach him, but I'll look around for him. And Tim Belknap again. Yeah, Tim, I believe, is still alive. He's still in California, I think. But I don't know how to reach him either, but I'll keep trying. I would love to interview Rachel McLish, and I am friends with her on Facebook, so that's a possibility. Don Peters, I believe, passed away many years ago, so I don't think he's still with us anymore. And Bob Paris, I reached out to on Instagram, but again, I didn't hear back from him, so I'll keep trying. It's amazing how many of these guys I try to email, and they just don't email me back. So I thought they would want to share their stories with everybody, but I guess not. So I'll just keep trying, guys. That's all I can do. And then my friend Paul Cullen from Ireland said, greetings from your good friend and bodybuilding photographer from Ireland, Paul Cullen. I just want to say that I follow your transformation and the progress. You are doing amazing work. Keep it going and take any photos as possible. Be great to have in the future for memories. Keep being amazing, John, your true friend, Paul. Stay healthy and happy. All right. Thank you, Paul. Always good to hear from you. And I will be taking some more photos this week. And I do want to mention before we get to our interview with the great Mike Katz that we are brought to you also by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. Their certified and knowledgeable staff will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, which is 813-922-8939, or you can visit their brand new website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's FL for Florida, alternativemeds.com, or you can call them directly at 813-922-8939, and please mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they will give you a free consultation and also 20% off your order. And if you're listening to the show on iTunes, please go there and leave a review. I would really appreciate that, guys. That helps us with our ratings. So take a minute or two to go on iTunes and just leave a review of the show. And I would appreciate that. And any emails you guys want to send me, just send it again to naturalolympia@gmail.com with any suggestions you have for any future shows, or give me a review of the shows that we put up. I would love to hear your input, and I will read your emails on the air. All right, guys, here is our interview with the great Mike Katz, and this is a throwback interview from January of 2015. I hope you enjoy it. Here you go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legend Show, and my guest today is the legendary bodybuilder, Mike Katz. Mike was the 1970 IFBB Mr. America and the 1972 IFBB Mr. World, and he was also featured in the book and the movie Pumping Iron. Mike, how you doing?
Great. It's great to finally, after the holidays, get a chance to sit down and talk with you and be able to enjoy our friendship and your viewership.
Yeah, it is. We know we were supposed to have you on a couple weeks ago, and a lot of our fans of the Bodybuilding Legend Show was looking forward to hearing your conversation. So I'm glad we finally got a chance to talk to you. Well, Mike, let's start from the very beginning. I, along with millions of other people, have seen the movie Pumping Iron, and I know you were featured pretty prominently in that movie. And one of the things you said in the movie was that you started off as a football player with the New York Jets. When did you start weight training, and when did you start competing in bodybuilding?
Well, I'm 70 now, so if you go back to when I was a kid your age, 15 or 16 years old.
I wish.
You looked that young. I had an opportunity, unfortunately, to be picked on. A lot of kids, like I tried to explain in the movie, and a lot of kids go through a difficult, challenging time when they're growing up from a boy to a man. And in my neighborhood, I didn't have the right last name. At a Catholic church on a street corner up the street, and mm-hmm. with a Jewish last name, in the amount of anti-Semitism that would occur from that. I remember once a woman next door who was a didn't have kids and was a widow, and she was a very cruel woman. And one day when I was maybe 9 or 10 years old, she called me a kike.
Wow.
And I really didn't know what that word meant, so I went and asked my father. And my father was so angry, and I never saw my father mad ever like that in his life. I mean, he stormed out the house and went next door and gave that lady a lecture on never using that word in front of me again.
Wow.
You know, that would be, I'm sure, like the N-word if you were black, or some other derogatory ethnic slur. But I can remember not only my father being on my side, but I also had this thing of that prejudice that comes from some people.
Right.
And, you know, beyond the religious part of it and the neighborhood part of it and getting picked on and kind of being fat and four eyes, like I said in the movie, with my glasses and my hair wasn't the right style. I mean, I didn't have a great self-esteem, being made fun of, and the girl not liking me, and just trying to kind of identify who I was and what I was. And, you know, I went to a movie. It would be similar a few years ago to when Arnold made his first movie. And at that time, it wasn't Arnold, it was Steve Reeves. And instead of Conan, it was Hercules. And being impressionable at 11 or 12 and seeing this unbelievable man who I'd never seen that kind of a build before, you know, pulling with chains the pillars of the Roman Empire down with this superhuman strength, I was really funny. I was really influenced by that. I also was influenced by my father, who was a real athlete and fan, and his friends used to always come over and pat me on the head, and they would say, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And at, you know, 10 or 11, I would say, I want to be a pro football player. And I'm sure, you know, jokingly, that's something that a lot of kids want to do. And obviously at 10 or 11, these gentlemen that were my father's friends never took me serious. You know, how could you? It's everybody's dream to do that.
Right.
So, you know, the dreams of you know, being respected, having a good body and losing some of the baby fat, and also being a professional football player, obviously you had to go to high school first and prove yourself, and then college. I was in a position to have some early goals in my life, along with respecting my health education teacher in seventh grade, Mr. Grossa in Hampton. So I had my, you know, like climbing the mountain kind of goals set for myself at an early age, you know, to be a great bodybuilder, to be a great football player, to be a teacher. Those were my aspirations. So I, you know, set out on that trail and the journey to start accomplishing those. And back in the day, there was no real, other than the YMCAs, you know, if you had one, there really wasn't any place to lift other than your basement.
Right.
And, you know, you buy a Weider courses, you know, with Clarence Ross, who was a star back in the day in the 50s, and George Eiferman, you'd buy from Weider the courses, you'd put them on the wall, and then you'd copy the different pictures of what exercises to do on what day.
Right.
And I remember sort of borrowing, you know, sort of like, I never returned borrowing, like stealing a few plastic or metal milk cases, you know, that were on the side of the road. And I got a 2x12 board, and that was my bench. So I had two milk cases that they used to put milk in back in the 50s. So I had my own little gym. I had the posters on the wall, and I I actually started, you know, with really no training and no help, I started to get better and stronger, because it was probably just at that point, you know, when you're 13, where the hormones start kicking in and you start getting the male, secondary male characteristics. So, you know, in the day, you know, I wanted to play football. There was no organized football, so you basically had a gang fight in your backyard with a neighborhood kid, and that was like the football that you learned back in the 50s, because there was no organized football. So I started getting stronger, you know, and started dominating the football games in the backyard when I was a little kid, could run through people and break tackles, and I was getting stronger, and I guess it sort of went through my head that, you know, working out weights was going to get me a lot of improvement in what I wanted to do. Also, back in the day, the most successful ad in the history of print advertising was Charles Atlas.
Right.
And that was in every comic book, and up until recently, that same ad that started in the 40s went all the way through into 2000, which was the 98-pound weakling who got his hand kicked in his face by the He-Man who walked by with all the girls admiring him. And, you know, when you're little, even, you know, I would say probably as an adult, it would be hard to admit it. But as a little kid, you could kind of at least admit it to yourself. That sounds pretty good. You know, let me do this Charles Atlas course.
Right.
Let me not get sand kicked in my face or bullied anymore. And let me have all the beautiful girls. I mean, that even as an adult sounds pretty good. So, you know, I got even more enticed to weight training, and I got better. And as I got better, you know, high school, then I started playing football, not in the neighborhood, but now I was a sophomore in high school because it was no freshman year, and I started playing, you know, high school football. You know, and the coaches back in the 50s would say, you know, you can't lift weights.
Right.
I remember I could throw a ball, you know, at 15 years old, I was throwing at almost 90 miles an hour.
Wow.
As a 15-year-old, and I had a professional player named Bob Boffleston, who played with Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And he said I threw harder at 15 than he did in the major leagues.
Wow.
So I was a good baseball player, but the baseball coach at the high school said, if you lift weights, you can't play baseball. You get muscle bound, which we all know about that misnomer. So I had to play track because I couldn't play baseball. It broke my father's heart because I probably would have, out of all the sports, been a better baseball player than any bodybuilder or football player. But needless to say, I played track to support my football improvement. And I did like 9 events, like decathlon, and the 100, the 220, and shot put, high jump, discus. So I was really able to develop a keen balance and strength. And then I became good enough in high school to be an All-American high school player and was recruited to go to West Point and Boston College and Richmond University on scholarships, but I wanted to stay home. I was a home buddy kind of person, probably kind of a big baby and didn't want to leave my mother I wasn't trying to get away. A lot of kids try to get away from their parents. I, to this day, wish my parents were still alive because I never wanted to get away from them.
Right.
We had a great college team that had people playing professional football right in New Haven called Southern Connecticut State College, which is now a university. And I figured, you know, if I'm going to play professional football, since we've got 3 guys playing in the NFL from my college, I could go to school at home, live at home, have all the support I needed, and still, if I'm good enough, be able to be a great college and professional player.
Mm-hmm.
So lifting weights, you know, I kind of broke through, and the football coach and the track coach really didn't understand what weight training was, but they knew I was getting faster and stronger. I was the fastest guy in the National Football League as an offensive or defensive lineman. And you're, you know, I'm a white guy, you know,
yeah,
being able to beat, you know, any ethnic group in my position. I was running with full equipment back in 1968-69 when we won the Super Bowl. I was running a 4.640 with full equipment on a grass field, not a track suit with cleats on AstroTurf. So I probably, that would have been a 4.5 or a 4.4. I could dunk a basketball at 270 pounds.
Wow.
So I had good attributes to being a football player and an athlete. So I kept training, and in high school I was young. I think I was maybe 15 or 16. I went to my first bodybuilding contest even while I was playing football, because I trained at the local Y, and there was guys that were really good. A guy named Joe LaPorte. That was back in the Joe Abenda days,
mm-hmm.
when Joe Abenda was in the AAU, and I was going in IFBB contests. And I had a guy in Meriden named Joe LaPorte, who was probably one of the best bodybuilders, similar to the John DiCola. John DiCola was a Mr. America for Weir back in, I think, the year before I won in 70. I think he was 69.
Yeah, he was,
same,
right.
68.
Mm-hmm.
And then DiCola was 69. He came from Massachusetts. So this guy was, like, as good as him. And I had an opportunity to hitchhike. When I was 14 years old, I would hitchhike 30 miles a day to go to the Meriden YMCA in Meriden to train with Joe LaPorte, because I knew training with him I'd become better. So here, in those days it wasn't dangerous to hitchhike. A lot of people did.
Right.
And it's just, basically I was lucky, because the same guy, kind of picked me up every day who was going to Meriden, and then I usually got the same guy coming home. So it's pretty neat that, 30 miles a day to hitchhike to go to YMCA in Meriden, which is a town in Connecticut.
Wow, that's crazy.
So I know I'm going kind of back and forth with a lot of things, but hopefully the audience can understand sort of where I came from, what motivated me to start. In college, I was good enough to be all conference, and I was signed as a free agent with the New York Jets in 67 and played all the way through almost when they won the Super Bowl in 69. I was ready. I was married that summer of the Super Bowl season, and I was also got my draft notice for Vietnam. So it was kind of a tenuous situation. I went to college to be a health education teacher, which I said earlier, because my seventh grade idol was an ex-Marine who was a health teacher, and I wanted to be like him back when I was 12 years old. So I'm saying, here I am married. I had a knee operation, which may have curtailed my football career. I'm looking at the draft. I'm educated to be a teacher. I'm going to be far more valuable teaching health education for 35 years with substance abuse and suicide and teen pregnancy. I got more to offer than, going to fight in Vietnam. And obviously, there is some guilt. I didn't go to Canada. I didn't burn my draft card. I legitimately got a teacher deferment, and I know I affected tens of thousands of kids' lives in a positive way, coaching and teaching.
Hmm.
But still, there is a little bit of hesitancy in reference to some of my friends coming back in flag-draped coffins from Vietnam.
Right.
And that bothers me a little bit. And what I'm doing now is one of the other things I'm really passionate about is cars, and especially street rod, high-performance types of cars. I have a small car collection. And I'm now producing for the Air Force for recruiting. I'm producing a automotive tribute to the P-51 Mustang, which was the plane that helped win World War II. That was the fighter that used to protect the B-52s on their bombing runs into Berlin. So, and then the Mustang automobile was named after the P-51 Mustang plane. And the famous plane is called the Old Crow. Anybody historically goes into your computer and looks for the Old Crow P-51 Mustang. It had it on the fuselage of the plane up where the engine is. They used to name the planes. Sometimes they would draw sort of a half-naked girl.
Mm-hmm.
It was called nose art. It was the nose part of a plane back in World War II, and they would draw the pictures of maybe their girlfriend.
Right.
Enola Gay was the plane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. The first atomic bomb was called Enola Gay, and that was the pilot's mother. That was her name, Enola Gay. So, this plane is going to be used in the Air Force for recruiting. They're going to take it throughout the country. It's a 1932 Ford. It's chopped. It's a three-window. For those guys out there who are automotive buffs, got a 2,000 horsepower aircraft engine, a 12-cylinder aircraft engine in it. It's got the dials and the gauges and the seat and the stick and the rudder pedals right out of a P-51 Mustang. So it's a single-seat car. So you're going to drive it as if you were driving a fighter plane.
Okay.
And it's going to be painted exactly like the P-51 Mustang. And the famous guy that many of your listeners know is Roush. Roush Mustang. Jack Roush Ford, which is Roush Fenway in NASCAR. Jack Roush has got a duplicate Old Crow P-51, actually original fighter plane that he flies.
Okay.
So, you know, this is sort of my way of giving back to the military when I didn't give my life in Vietnam.
Right.
And taught school. It's sort of my passion to give back to the military the respect that they deserve by helping recruit kids, you know, with the book being the car that will go on tour throughout the United States.
Right.
If you go online and you look at the other car that I produced, is the Pumping Iron tribute car.
Hmm.
Matter of fact, that's a 32 Ford. It's a high boy convertible. That's got a blown and injected small block in it. It's got all the murals along the sides of the movie Pumping Iron.
Oh, cool.
So the most famous slides from the film are on the sides of the car. And it's pretty neat. If the listeners go to Mike Katz Pumping Iron tribute car, there's a 15-minute clip from Ohio about 6 years ago. Arnold and Franco uncovered the car at the trade show.
Okay.
It's pretty neat. You know, I remember Franco telling Arnold, you know, I look better in these slides than you two. And he's blowing up the hot water bottle in one of the slides.
Right.
And he goes, look, Arnold, you know, there's me blowing up the hot water bottle because he did that in the movie Pumping Iron.
Right,
to show how strong he was. So, you know, my career goes in a lot of different directions, from bodybuilding to football to teaching, you know, to my admiration for the military and producing, you know, show cars.
Right.
I recently purchased a famous car from Smokey Unick. And Smokey Unick, they'll finally make a movie. Smokey Unick is, let me just try to, he would be like in race car notoriety. He would sort of be like Billy Martin.
Okay.
Was just the manager of the Yankees. Just a real individual, interesting character. And I bought his Indianapolis 1957 race car that raced in the Indy 500. So I really enjoy cars and collecting them. And I have 5 Planet Fitnesses as well.
Right.
So when we used to be World Gym, and then we changed 10 years ago. We thought that Planet Fitness had a better business plan than World Gym did. World Gym was a licensed agreement to use the name. Planet Fitness is a real franchise like Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's. And there's over 900 worldwide. And within 3 years, they say it'll be 2,000. They're opening up about 300 clubs a year.
Wow.
Planet Fitness, you know, for $10 a month. And it's
right.
Beautiful million-dollar clubs. You know, they're not heavy-duty clubs. You're not going to, you know, scream and yell and squat 700 pounds. It's, you know, more of a beginner type of a gym where you feel real safe and comfortable without feeling hassled or ridiculed by bullies, if you must be. Or and people who might feel insecure.
Like, that's, let me go back to your...
And then, you know, the other thing, John, is, and I just, you know, we can kind of get off on to maybe specifically giving you sort of an overview of the time that I was a little kid and being bullied all the way to where I am right now with my Planet Fitnesses. But I'm also excited to be a part of a group called Ground Floor Health and Wellness. And it's a company that has products that are scientifically backed and they're clinically proven. Now, everybody can say that, but if you go online at all under Dr. Donald Lehman, 34 years of metabolic study, he's kind of the guru of metabolism. He's the scientist doctor that helped to develop the products. Again, it's Donald Lehman.
Okay.
And I got involved after 40 years of, after back in when I retired in 70s, 1986. I went in the Olympia. I think I was second to Waller.
Right.
And then I kind of said, that's it. I'm retiring. And then I did come back in, I think, 80 or 82, and I did come back to compete. And I was able to beat Waller, even though I didn't place high. My goal was to come in natural. I was drug tested natural. I'm on stage with people, you know, who I know were not drug tested. And it was just an ego thing for me to know I could be naturally good enough to compete against guys who had no limits in reference to how good they were going to get.
Right.
And I beat Waller. So, you know, here I am, you know, retiring, knowing that I beat Waller, knowing I went on stage drug free.
Right.
And, you know, I had kids to bring up. My son was born in 1970. Now he's like 12 years old in 1982. And I said, that's it. You know, I just got to concentrate on bringing my kids up.
Right.
But I still judge. I judge all over the world. I judge the Arnold. I judge the Olympia. I'm involved still with writing articles. And this particular company called Ground Floor, you know, you can friend, it's called on Facebook, Friend My Son. That's my son, Mike, and I on Facebook, Mike Katz. And we're online all the time preaching what we believe in nutritionally and with the products that Dr. Lehman has produced. I lost 40 pounds in the last 3 months. And I feel like I've been reborn again.
Wow.
So I feel real strongly. And I have usually, back in 78, there was a company called Futuron Industries, and they produced a product for those people who might be as old as me. They produced a product called Slender Now, and it was a powdered, revolutionary, really well-produced weight loss program. It was multi-level marketed, you know, like Avon or Shaklee or Herbalife, and the company did extremely well. As a matter of fact, we, that year in 78, we sponsored the Mr. Olympia for Arnold. If you go back historically, as two sponsors were, it was Futuron Industries. Then there was a protein scare in 1978, 79. Some people, you know, throughout the United States were using liquid collagen, you know, animal liquid.
Yeah.
And they weren't using anything else. They were just using that. So this had nothing to do with powdered, well-balanced protein powders. But we all got kind of like when the government unveiled 35 people dying of these liquid diets, the whole industry shut down. And meaning the multi-level marketed industry has anything having to do with protein. Avon was able to stay in business because they're not a nutritional company.
Right.
They're a, you know, toothpaste, mouthwash, makeup, lipstick, and so forth. So Avon made it through. But most of the nutritional companies that were, you know, multi-level marketed companies went out. And I remember probably from 1979 to today, I would be at least once or twice a year, a company would come to me and they would talk about how great their product was. Why don't you try it? You know, we need you and your expertise and your credibility. And I rejected all the way until 6 months ago. I've rejected at least once or twice a year to be involved with companies that I don't believe the ingredients are proper. I don't believe the science and the white papers are legitimate because there aren't any. They're just a marketing tool for people to make money. And it's not like I don't need more money, but I'm set. I'm fine.
Yeah.
I'm not doing this for the money. I'm doing this because I believe that the ability to get kids and adults back healthy again by healthily dropping body weight, that this is my mission, because that's what I taught for 35 years. It is also a great business opportunity. That's why they call it Ground Floor Health and Wellness Company, which is which sells a product called Kivana. It's with a Q. And Kivana is the name of the actual product company, but they kind of marketed under Ground Floor Health and Wellness. So, you know, I'm not trying to get people to sign up, but it's a great business opportunity. I know that Florida has literally no people involved in that business opportunity at this point. It's like an open area, that in California. Mm-hmm. Connecticut is like crazy. This product up in Connecticut, in other foreign countries, it's extremely well received. But there's so many opportunities for like gyms, karate studios, beauty salons, so many different kinds of people who can say, you know what? And you know, Mike Arruzzioni, the guy, the most famous athletic competition in the history of sports, was Miracle on Ice when Americans in 1980 beat the Russians.
Right.
Well, Mike Arruzzioni from Boston was the guy who scored the winning goal. And Bart Connors, an Olympian in gymnastics, there's a lot of really good, authentic, honest people who are with this company and believe in the company. So I'm just to say, I'm one of them. My son and daughter-in-law are part of the of my sort of rebirth nutritionally of what's going on. I can't talk more highly of that as what I'm doing right now.
Okay. Mike, let's go back to your bodybuilding career. I was looking on MuscleMemory.com, and they said you did the 1964 Teenage Mr. America, got fourth place. Was that your first bodybuilding show as a teenager?
No, that I had competed in other teenage competitions, but not in the national show.
Okay.
So, you know, and it's interesting, Dennis Tenorino won that day. And I had a great time. I sat next to Paul Anderson. He did a strength exhibition.
Oh, really? Okay.
And I sat on a bench, like a bench press bench, and his rear end sitting on the bench, he took up all the way from the stanchion of where you would pick the weight up. He sat against the stanchion, and he had just about enough room for my rear end at the end of the bench.
Wow.
He had the Dixie Derrick. He was, like, considered the strongest man that ever lived, Paul Anderson. And as they said, that was a memorable thing, you know, not only Tenorino, God bless Dennis, you know, winning. Now, I was okay with that because I did very good. There was another guy named Dotrell, and he was a good amateur AAU guy. If you go back historically, I'm not sure who was in third. But, you know, at that point, the place in the top five in the national teenage show, I was happy with that. Because I was, you know, I played football all the way up until 69. And I won Mr. America in 1970.
Right.
And it competed maybe three or four times in Mr. America while I was playing with the Jets. So
really? Wow.
Here I've got a bodybuilder's body and I'm on the football field. And today, it's, you know, you see some of these guys who are so ripped, you know, some of the linebackers and
right.
just like genetic freaks, you know.
Right.
I was like the only guy that really, my roommate was named Steve Chomasek. He was a 65-foot shot putter from Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
He was a defensive lineman. And I remember one day, there was a guy, Sherman Plunkett, for Jet fans. Sherman Plunkett, you know, he was like 380 pounds, maybe 6 feet two. He was an offensive tackle. He had 9 ripples in the back of his head. He had it shaved, and I used to count. I said, Mr. Plunkett, let me count those lines in the back of your skull. Well, my friend Steve Chomasek, one day in practice with Weave Eubank, was the coach. He took this 380-pound offensive tackle, lifted him with his hands underneath his shoulder pads. He lifted him off the ground.
Wow.
Threw him. Well, obviously, at that point, seeing that, you know, he ended up at least 2 or 3 years for the Jets for that one movement against Sherman Plunkett.
Right.
So those are some kind of cool stories. But we were the only ones, Chomasek and myself. Al Atkinson was the middle linebacker. He did a little bit of lifting. But beyond that, even then, they were just starting to accept the fact that weight training would be okay for football, and that's 69.
Wow. So what years did you play with the Jets then, Mike?
I graduated from college in 66, summer 66. So then
okay.
I played through the 67 season, then I came back to the 68, 69. I had got injured against the Patriots, and I had a knee that should have been operated on. The great surgeon, James Nicholas, whose son now I think is a team physician with the Jets, he had operated on Namath 8 times. He was a team surgeon.
Okay.
Bank surgeon. And I kind of egotistically, they call me Superman. because they couldn't believe when I would come into the shower, you know, somebody could be built like me,
right,
and run like the wind. And especially the black guys, they really loved, and I got along good with them because many of the players were Texans from down south, and they kind of hung out, Curly Johnson and Pete Lammons and these guys from Texas, they kind of hung out in their group. And here's some, you know, Jewish kid from a small college in the Northeast. I had nobody to hang around with, you know. And, I tended to like Verlin Biggs and Sherman Plunkett. And I had a good time hanging out with minorities like myself.
Right.
Welcome right. By them and still do. Winston Hill, who is Willis Reed's brother-in-law. Winston Hill was a great 6'7", 310-pound offensive tackle, and he was all pro. I don't know if he's in the Hall of Fame, but he's in the Ring of Circle at Jet Stadium in New York, and he was a shout-out to him. If anybody ever knows who Winston Hill is and says hello for me, I would love that.
Okay. So when did you first go to Gold's Gym out in California? When did you make that pilgrimage? We just did an interview with Bill Grant, and he said he would see you over there in the summers every year out in California.
Joe Weider at the time was looking for, you know, he had Dave Draper, kind of Larry Scott had gone past, you know, won the Olympian. It was now Sergio Oliva.
Right.
So Sergio Oliva was like the guy to beat. So he knew that eventually if he brings Arnold from Austria, that he's sort of like the great white hope.
Right.
You know, he can market the magazine and he's handsome, not that Sergio isn't. It's just, you know, business is business. And he just felt, of course, that, you know, a guy, and it's interesting, who could speak, Arnold, don't get mad at me, you know, who could speak better English, Sergio, you know, with his Cuban accent, or Arnold with his German accent.
Right.
Maybe that was a toss-up, although maybe I have to say Arnold spoke a little bit clearer English than Sergio did.
Right.
But, you know, Arnold was going to sell more magazines than Sergio. I mean, it's a fact. And, you know, became good enough to beat Sergio. And he needed a training partner. And in Austria, you know, Joe Weider asked Arnold who he wanted to train with, you know, who was sort of a person he wanted to meet. So Arnold said, Mike Katz, Big Mike, I want him out here.
Oh, really? Okay.
So Weider got in touch with me because I used to train with Joe Weider before he moved to California. His organization was in Union City, New Jersey.
Right.
He lived in a high-rise luxury apartment right near the United Nations on the east side of Manhattan.
Okay.
I would go down there and I would talk to him. I would train with him. And I'll never forget, I mean, he pushed me once to use 110-pound dumbbells to do curls.
Wow.
110, I mean, a barbell 110 is enough.
Yeah.
And he like was like Bear Bryant or Vince Lombardi. Oh, Mike, yeah, you know, I know you can do more. The 85 start pigeon weights. Joe, 85, you're trying to kill me. I mean, I got up to over 100 pounds, you know, alternate swinging,
right,
you know, dumbbell curls. And he loved that.
Yeah.
And when he moved to California, he wanted me out there. So at the end of my teaching in June, I would pack up, go to California for a month. Live with him and train with him and Franco, although nobody could train with Franco. You know, Franco didn't know what he was doing. Nothing against Franco. Franco just knew that what he was doing, which made no sense to anybody, but he knew that it was working for him.
Right.
So it's one of those things where everybody would scratch their head. He doesn't do any warm-ups. He starts with 500 pounds of a squat. And the rest of us are going, oh, yeah, right. We're going to start with 500 and not three or four warm-up sets. But Franco was like a genetic freak.
Yeah.
So, you know, Arnold says, look, if I'm not here, don't train with Franco. You can't trust him. But he did put me in Franco's car once because he couldn't drive me someplace. So he says, well, you could trust Franco. He's a great driver. And everybody at Gold's Gym you know, was kind of rolling their eyes, and I couldn't figure out why they were rolling their eyes about Franco's driving ability.
Right.
You know, Arnold's got a Volkswagen. He had to have a German car. Franco's got an Alfa Romeo because he had to have an Italian car. Well, by the time I got to where I had to go, I'm pretty white, but I was whiter than a ghost. I don't think there was ever four wheels ever on the ground once I stepped into the car. And I can remember the following day, Arnold says, "Hey, Mike, how was the ride with Frank?" And the whole Gold's Gym, everybody started cracking up. Gun, you know, you suckered me again.
Yeah.
And not only, he gave me the right advice not to train with Franco, but he didn't give me the right advice about not to drive with him.
What did you think of Arnold when you first met him, Mike? Did you know him from the magazines before you met him in person?
Not really. He wasn't really, you know, I mean, maybe a little, but I mean, the stars back then were Dave Draper.
Right.
You know, and Larry Scott, even though he was before me.
Right.
Frank Zane, you know, Arnold came in. I remember Arnold got beat by Zane in Florida.
Yeah, in 68.
Because he was really pudgy.
Yeah.
And he wasn't really refined like he became. And Frank Zane taught him a good lesson about, you know, coming in a contest smooth.
Right.
But we hit it off immediately. I mean, just it was almost like we were kindred spirits and mm-hmm. brothers. You know, we could use about, you see, I had stronger legs and I was stronger in my bench. He was stronger in curls.
Mm-hmm.
So where I needed help was being motivated by him being stronger in my weak areas. And then when he would falter on squats and leg presses, and I could do almost 100 and something pounds more than him,
mm-hmm.
he couldn't understand it and would be motivated to try to get his legs better. So it was a perfect, and we're about the same height and about the same weight. And, you know, he also knew that he could pick on me and get away with it. So he had a perfect fall guy
mm-hmm.
involved as a, and continue to be a friend. I just got an award from the March of Dimes, which is one of the greatest charities that you get, because they're there for, you know, for babies who are premature.
Right.
March of Dimes now. And I got a Legend Award from them this past year. And Arnold sent a beautiful tribute on tape.
Mm-hmm.
So when he introduced my award, Arnold introduced me over a big screen.
Oh, nice.
A projector and told the world, you know, what he thought of me, which was at least nice things, because maybe he could have said that would have been embarrassing, but he kept it on a professional level.
What was the atmosphere like at Gold's Gym back in those days, Mike, at the original Gold's Gym in the 1970s?
Yeah, that was on Pacific. It was on Pacific Avenue there. It was about three blocks from the beach.
Yeah.
I'm up the beach. You know, bodybuilders in those days, we stuck together because everybody was against us. You know, the guy who was an athlete who maybe didn't have a great body, he would say, you know, we're narcissistic and muscle bound and can't touch our toes, because even athletes at the time were kind of jealous of us. And, you know, other people, intellectuals, might say, well, the guy must be gay, or, you know, how could somebody just look at themselves all day?
Yeah.
Because they really didn't understand that what we were doing. And what we were doing, I mean, the movie and the book Pumping Iron explained that we're just regular guys, you know, Arnold and Franco and Louis and the people in the book, myself. We just have a dream to be the best built person in the world, not climb Mount Everest or become a professional football player or a great opera singer.
Right.
We're just normal people that sort of have a sport that really isn't understood. So the movie, I think, really created a tolerance for what we were doing. But up to then, I mean, we had to stick together.
Uh-huh.
Nobody was making any money. I think Mr. Olympia was $1,000. You could get maybe $100 to do a posing exhibition.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, nobody was making a lot of money. It wasn't a career until Arnold was able, with his business sense, to be able to market himself and control Weider. And have Weir understand how valuable he was, sort of like Joe Namath when he got the 400,000, which is nothing today. But back in the day when I was playing, you know, $18,000 you could make as an offensive lineman. Yeah. Now, a school teacher was making $6,000. So it was three times more than a school teacher would make. But here's a guy that comes in and makes $400,000.
Yeah.
So, and they did that to try to get the AFL, you know, incorporated within the NFL. And then when the Jets beat the Colts in Super Bowl III after Namath guaranteed the victory, it really brought the AFL right up even. And then they combined leagues, and now the National Football League with the American and National Conference within those leagues. So, you know, it was, you know, there was always a little bit of gamesmanship, you know, with me and Waller. But a lot of that was because we were competitors. So they were able to look at me beating him for Mr. World, then him beating me for Mr. Universe, and then him winning in the contest in South Africa, and looking at my disappointment and not knowing that he had stolen a T-shirt. And I didn't know. And it's interesting, that whole T-shirt incident, it took me 30 years. Arnold came out with, you know, the real truth about the filming of the movie Pumping Iron and what really happened. You know, when he came clean, that section with Robbie Robinson and Ken Waller on the football field throwing
right.
football
right.
with Roger Callard, that was done 6 months after the movie was shot.
Really? Wow.
So, you know, they were able to edit it
yeah.
as if, you know, the T-shirt got stolen and this is how they did. So it was not the way it really happened, because I played against a guy named Ernie Ladd, who ended up becoming a professional wrestler with WWE.
Right.
And he played for the Houston Oilers, 6'9", 365 pounds. He would turn your helmet around. I saw him do it, so that the face mask was facing the back of your head.
Wow.
I mean, I had nightmares going to bed at night knowing you're going to play the Houston Oilers and Ernie Ladd.
Right.
Now, there was other great ones, too, of course. You know, Bubba Smith was the great defensive tackle for the Colts with Johnny Unitas.
Right.
But, I mean, if I'm not going to be psyched out playing against these killers on a football field, how the hell is Waller going to psych me out?
Right.
I was just looking. I still have that T-shirt. One day, either go in a museum.
Oh, really? Or
hopefully Arnold will have enough motivation to make a bodybuilding museum, like
yeah.
the Hall of Fame for baseball, because we don't have a museum. And I will the T-shirt, you know, and my belt, which I wore in the movie to
right.
the museum. But if not, then, you know, maybe one day it'll be on eBay. I don't know if it'll fetch much money.
So did it really happen, Mike? I mean, did you?
Oh,
really,
yeah.
Were you really missing your T-shirt? Is that when they? Is that when
I was. It was my lucky T-shirt, and I was looking for that. And
right.
the content, it's interesting, if you kind of look at the way it was done with the filming.
Yeah.
When I go at the very end of my segment, when I go to walk up the steps,
yeah.
and the camera shoots the back of my head,
right.
and I say, and I've got to find my T-shirt, I've got to
right.
go shoot Waller's hand, because I didn't know he stole it. And I got to find the T-shirt. You didn't hear that coming out of my mouth, because they were on the back of my head.
Mm.
They verbally put that in to that particular part, because that's how you make movies.
Yeah.
Now, you know, in the when the movie came out, it was released at the Plaza Theater in New York, and it had a bunch of, you know, sort of, in a way, kind of washed up movie stars and stuff that
right.
were there. They weren't, you know, it wasn't John Wayne or something like that.
Right.
It was just, you know, some people who had made some movies, and they kind of gathered them up, put them in an evening count,
yeah.
and they went to the opening. And it was in the Plaza Theater, right next to the Plaza Hotel. There was lights in the sky and all that business. And when I never saw the movie, and they asked me, you know, I love George Butler and Charles Gaines, those are the guys who wrote and directed the movie and stuff. But, you know, I trusted them. And I said, look, you know, you want to give me like $1,000 and I have to sign a release and I haven't seen the movie. Trust me, they said, you're going to love the movie. Well, you know, being naive, and trusted him. Those guys stayed at my house when they filmed in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. They did the book. What was there not to trust? So I signed the release and now never saw the film. Now it's, 2 months later, the film is being shown at the Plaza Theater. And I saw how they edited that part with my T-shirt. I walked out of the theater.
Really? Wow.
It probably took me 8 to 10 years to kind of, maybe even longer, because it's still a little stinging.
Really?
Now, even though I'm 70, you would say, get over it.
Yeah.
it's easy for anybody out there to say, get over it. But that, if it depicted me correct, that I was some weak, spirited guy, who was looking for some stupid T-shirt and getting psyched out
right.
by it, and Waller beat me, I would have crushed him.
Right.
I would have crushed him with one hand, let alone worry about a T-shirt. But the way they did it was destructive to my ego
yeah.
and my personality. And I don't think it was a very nice thing to do with people who you trust. Now, have I forgiven them? Sure. Because in the end, I'm talking to you, and I'm not aware of where, Ken is at this point in his life. And I've become sort of a household name in bodybuilding because I was the only guy at the time to have kids, be married, be educated, have a teaching job, play professional football. I had so many things more than Arnold. I mean, Arnold had what? Arnold kind of didn't have an education at the time, and mm-hmm. There's no jealousy. But if you look at what he had and what I had, I mean, I had my kids, I had my wife, I had educated degrees, was a teacher. I had a lot of things that a lot of those guys even today never had.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that resonated with the audience where I became, at least what they tell me, sort of a cult hero from the movie.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't want to be like Arnold. He wouldn't even go to his father's funeral.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to be like Louis because, Louis was being controlled by his father, and most people don't like that kind of overseeing. Mm-hmm. I found it difficult to understand in a way his whole thing in the first place. So he could pick up a car in Sardinia and move it because it's stuck in a parking place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, what Arnold became and what Franco became and these people have become very successful people, and it's a tribute to their desire to fulfill other goals, whether it's acting or business or chiropractic medicine.
Right.
But back that day, most people resonated with me because that's most people who watched the film were married, had kids, and had to work a job.
Right.
And they lifted weights like I did. So, being angry at the improper editing of the movie had to take a back seat to having it released and having it become popular. Now it's on Netflix. So
yeah.
Here we go years later or whatever. And now I'm kind of reborn again.
Yeah, well, it's a classic movie, I think, among all bodybuilders, And I think you're right, Mike. I think your involvement with the film and your showing you in the film, I think, from what I'm reading, a lot of the critics, when they reviewed the movie, they said you provided a sort of a human element to bodybuilders. And I think that was the great thing about the movie, was that it showed bodybuilders as individual human beings, where before, I think, the general public must have saw bodybuilders as just a bunch of muscle-bound people who they didn't understand,
Yeah, that's something that's kind of an interesting thought, because I know I've thought that before, but it even puts a little bit more strength to that, normal people like my cats can achieve things, and it's not a bunch of wackos that are out there, bouncing around Muscle Beach.
Hey, Mike, let me ask you about Ken Waller, because, they portrayed this big rivalry between you guys, but obviously you knew Ken pretty well, going to Gold's Gym every summer, and we just talked to Bill Grant, and he said Ken Waller wasn't like he was portrayed in the movie. He was a real nice guy. Did you guys have a good relationship, or was there a real rivalry between you?
Well, there was a rivalry, but there was, for me, there was no, I was never jealous of him. The first time, I think, I don't know if he beat me in Mr. International. It was in Tijuana. They had a year. I think it was like 69 or maybe 70. I think he beat me in Mr. International in Mexico, and then I came back in New York and beat him in Mr. World.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a natural rivalry, but, you know, I mean, he's, you know, he kind of like maybe was, I mean, he wasn't beyond, he didn't have a gun to his head to do what he did in the movie. I think that even Bill Grant would say that was part of his persona, is, mm-hmm. you know, being, you know, for him to be kind of, to do that wasn't out of context with his personality. It doesn't mean he's a bad person.
Right.
Like Arnold, it doesn't mean he's a bad person. It just is, you couldn't make me do what he did to me. I couldn't do that to him.
Okay.
I would have got down on a football field in a wrestling ring, and I would have attempted to try to kick his ass, you know, before I would have tried to ridicule him and hurt him. But it just doesn't mean he's a bad guy.
Right.
I'm not going to do that. Would Arnold do what Waller did? Of course, Arnold did that the whole movie. So, I mean, you know, Waller was no more or less involved than Arnold. Arnold, in many cases, did worse things.
Right.
But he did them in funny ways that you kind of got to laugh. But they were like Don Rickles. I mean, they were still hurtful.
Right.
I remember once when he said, I'm going to give Franco all the wrong advices, because he listens to me like I'm his mother.
Right.
That was right in the film. Well, when that film came out, the friendship between Franco and Arnold almost ended. Because, I mean, Franco's got a lot of pride being a strong man.
Right.
Just like I do being a football player. And then when Arnold says, you know, like, he listens to me like I'm his mother, and I can give him the wrong advice and fool him.
Right.
You know, he wasn't very happy with that. It's interesting that movie caused, not almost, it almost caused the breakup of a friendship with Franco and Arnold, but it caused the breakup of Lou Ferrigno and his father. Lou got, and I don't know the exact story, because I love Louie and his wife, but there was stuff that was none of my business, but I know that there was a falling out after the film. Now, whether it was his second wife or whether it was a business deal that went sour, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is that he and his father loved each other before and during the film, and after the film, things ended.
Wow.
So that was a sad part of the film.
Yeah.
I have not asked Louis, and neither would I. It's none of my business. All I know is they didn't see each other much, and I know the film did not help their friendship as a father and son, which is
sad. Yeah, yeah. What did you think about Arnold and Sergio Oliva, their rivalry? I mean, I know you were around in 1969 and 1970 when Sergio beat Arnold and then Arnold beat Sergio. I know a lot of bodybuilding fans are always debating who was better, Sergio or Arnold.
It's interesting, you know, the day that Arnold beat him, I've seen Arnold lose to him because I had competed the same day, because they held Mr. World, Mr. America, and Mr. Olympia. They held all the shows in the same day.
Right.
In the same venue. And I remember on stage, you know, the year Arnold beat him, I think that might have been 1970.
1970, yeah.
Yeah, and he and I remember, you know, the crowd, because I think Lou Ferrigno, hold on one second. I think Lou Ferrigno, not Lou Ferrigno, let me just get it straight. Sergio Oliva had been twice or three times Mr. Olympia, and Arnold had gotten beat by him once.
Right.
So now they come back again, and Arnold figures, let me use every tactic I can use to try to get an advantage over him. So, you know, being the reigning Mr. Olympia and being in New York and being against, you know, a Cuban-American against an Austrian from another country, you know, the crowd at the beginning, you know, was screaming Sergio. Sergio, yeah, 3,000-4,000 people was a big crowd then.
Right.
And it looked as if Sergio kind of had it. There was some Arnold, but I would say at least 60-70% of the audience were screaming Sergio. So they're posing and posed down and whatnot. Then all of a sudden, Arnold, you know, and I was right there. Arnold said, "I'm tired. Why don't we give it a break?" And you know, poor Sergio, like poor me with the T-shirt, you know, and Franco with, you know, his getting screwed around with "I'm your mother, trust me." You know, there Sergio, you know, innocently walks off the stage. Arnold starts to walk off, jumps back on, and starts posing again. It looked like the whole audience went back now to Arnold.
Right.
And Sergio just was like, "What did I do?"
Right.
I don't think he realized it until it was too late that he gave Arnold just enough there in a close-fought contest that, you know, Arnold used whatever he needed to use. And he continues to do that today for the most part, except for a couple of missteps there in Arnold's life. He's been pretty much on top of things. So, and you kind of feel sorry for Sergio. And then they go to, I think, Essen, they go to Germany, I think, the following year. And, you know, I think you need to go look at the photos of that Mr. Olympia. That may have been 71.
72.
So you look at the photos and then you tell me. Or you go look at the photos when in Australia, you know, it was Mike Metzer and Arnold and Chris Dickerson and, you know, whoever. And then you can look at the pictures when Franco, you know, won the Mr. Olympia. And you could kind of, I mean, I think the audience in some ways, now I'm a judge. And, you know, your parents who love you in any sport are going to give you the benefit of the doubt. I mean, they just love you. They don't, your parents, I coached hockey in high school when I taught. And, you know, you could put a puck on the goal line where the goalie is, to the goal line. If the puck goes over the line, it's a goal. You could put a puck on the goal line. You could take the goalie out of a net and your kid's parents, that kid would come down the ice and he couldn't put the puck an inch over the goal line with no goalie. But I've got Wayne Gretzky. It's my son. He's Wayne Gretzky or Bobby Orr. So you can't, as a parent, divorce yourself from the love that you've got. And fans, in many cases, can't divorce and shouldn't. They shouldn't. If they think the worst guy in the show should win, that's their right. They paid their money. They have every right to feel that way. But the real judges, the writers, the photographers, the people who really know the sport, it would be interesting to look at and ask those people who would have been there and had nothing against or for Arnold or Sergio.
Right.
Is to ask those people, you know, the guys that write the magazine in Europe.
Right.
And the people who were there. It'd be interesting to get, I mean, you look at it and then you tell me. Now, Arnold was not in his best shape in Australia. And he wasn't in his best shape in Essen. The other guys were. So does, how do, there was a call the other day that helped Dallas win the game.
Right.
Against Detroit.
Right.
Totally outplayed them. And it was a call that you would have said, it was fixed. It's a 15-yard penalty in the red zone. They're going to get a first down in Detroit. They need it to score. There's a necessary roughness of a receiver. They count off the 15 yards. They think about it. Now, did Jerry Jones fix it? Did the NFL fix it because they figured Dallas is going to be a bigger draw in the playoffs than Detroit?
Right.
It was the most ridiculous call in the history of football in a meaningful game. And even the commissioner of the officials said it. So somebody must have got to someplace, or somebody was afraid to make a call, or somebody looked up. So the point is that call shouldn't have been made. Now, should the calls in Australia have been made? Should the call in Essen have been made? I don't know. I remember once trying to qualify for the Mr. Universe. And this is in the Sports Illustrated, so you can go back and you could actually read the Sports Illustrated article that was done on Parigno myself. Parigno wasn't in shape. It was the Mr. Universe in Italy, and we were competing in a show, and the winner of that show was going to go to the United States for the Mr. Universe in Italy. Well, Parigno wasn't. Now, if we're both in our best shape, is Louis better? Probably. Maybe. Okay, I can deal with it. But he wasn't better. And in the article, Arnold gets quoted and says, well, Louis, you know, Louis, when he's in his best shape, could beat Mike. But there was something said that was like the call that was made against the Lions that didn't get called, right?
Oh, you're talking about the Mr. International, right, Mike? The one that was held in California?
Mr. International, and yeah. Louis and I can remember the thing clear as day. I mean, you know, maybe if he was in his best shape, sure.
Yeah.
But he wasn't, and I was in great shape. Mm-hmm. And I didn't beat him. Matter of fact, somebody sent me the movie. I have a movie of that show.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, I have a movie of the show. And, I mean, you know, forget it. He's taller, he's bigger.
Yeah.
But he wasn't better that day. If you're smooth, you shouldn't win just because maybe a month later you're better. Yeah. You're not better. Like if it's a horse race, even though Secretariat might have lost and maybe it should have won, you don't give the freaking victory because you know when the flash goes off at the end of a horse race, you know, Parigno is finishing behind Secretariat.
Maybe. Right, right.
But it doesn't happen that way. So it is. It's not sour grapes. It really isn't. Right. I love Louis.
Right.
But, you know, it's just interesting how things do happen. But most of the time, to defend myself as a judge, most of the time, I mean, there's been times judging, like I want to sneak out the back door and I'll elbow, you know, Steve Weinberger, who's a good friend, or I'll elbow whoever is sitting next to me. You know, at the time it would have been Jim Raquel or it would have been Sandy Rinaldi, you know, the people I judge throughout the world with.
Right.
And I'm saying to, you know, I'm saying to Steve or Jimmy Mannion, I'm saying, you know, all hell's going to break loose. Just trust me. They go, what do you mean? I said, look, I've been up on that stage. You guys have it.
Yeah.
I know this audience. I know what's going to happen. And yeah, I said, just wait. And, you know, 10 minutes after, 2 seconds after the guy was crowned Mr. Whatever, the freaking audience, I was going to dive for underneath the table.
Yeah.
Because they went so crazy. Does that mean they're right? No. But it sometimes means that maybe we could have looked a little differently and saw things different than they did.
Yeah.
It just really depends. You know, when it's real, real close in a show, there are other factors that occur in judges' minds. I mean, we're not computers.
Right.
You know, if you are judging somebody and they're absolutely dead on and you know that one of the guys is the most detrimental person that you could ever vote for, and you've got to try to take all of this out of your brain, and most of the time we do. But, you know, everything does affect everything else.
Yeah.
And when you've got a great representative of a sport who you know is going to further the sport and it's tight, now, do you want a potential criminal? There's no criminals, but or a thug or a bad person that you know is not nice to the media, doesn't sign autographs, doesn't show up to posing exhibitions on time. You know, the way you act, and I'm just trying to think of an analogy with Dominican Sue, you know, the guy in the Detroit Lions, the nose tackle. I mean, he's done some vicious, even with football.
Right.
You say, well, how vicious could a football player, I mean, it's like war.
Right.
Playing football. But he's done things that aren't even allowed in war. He's done such bad things in his life, stepping on people and stuff.
Right.
Now all of a sudden he steps on a guy, and he's got a bad reputation to start with. He's already gotten fined. He's gotten suspended. Well, you know what? You don't have as much. That guy doesn't have as much rope. You know, you don't need a whole lot of rope to hang a guy like that.
Yeah.
Other people are just, you know, they say like Roger Clemens, and Andy Pettit. You know, Andy Pettit comes across with a drug issue. He comes across as a nice guy. He's up front. He said he did whatever, and people understand there was a mistake because everybody makes mistakes. Nobody's perfect.
Right.
But then somebody hides it, hides it, hides it, and there's so much information against them, you just don't respect that guy who continues to lie and fight as you do somebody that comes clean.
Right.
So that sort of does a little tiny bit, maybe a quarter of a percent. I wouldn't even say it does in a quarter of a percent if it's equal. If either guy can win, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes it has nothing to do with even personality, because you can have two great guys and the audience loves both of them and they're both great. They both would be great standard bearers of an award, but somebody's got to win.
Right.
And that's why there's an odd number of judges. So right. Somebody is going to go 4-3 or 6-5 or whatever.
Right. Hey, Mike, we were just talking about that 1970 Mr. Olympia, and I wanted to ask you an incident. Didn't Sergio demand to go into the Mr. America that year? The day he competed in the Olympia?
That's a great question, John. You know, I had spent, I think, 3 years, 67 through 69. Matter of fact, Chuck Sipes won one of those years. What a great strongman he was. And then it was Frank Zane, and then it was John DeCola, and then, you know, like, I had a good chance to win 1970.
Yeah.
So Sergio's like Cuban. Now, whether he was an American citizen, I'm not sure. But, you know, he basically, you know, sort of threatened the promoters about not going into Mr. Olympia if he couldn't go in Mr. America. I don't even know at that time if he had a citizenship. Right. He might have had a green card or something. So they pacified him and they said to him, well, we'll give you all the trophies, but just don't go into contest. So, you know, that was sort of a sidelight of him not ruining my day in the sun. Because probably would have had to give him back because I don't think he was an American citizen in 1970.
Right.
I don't even know if he must have been, because I know he was a Chicago police officer. So, you know, historically, it's hard for me to say whether he was or wasn't. But
right.
Tommy Minichiello, who's one of my group, he was a guy that owned Mid-City Gym.
Yeah.
He promoted all the contests then in New York at the Town Hall and at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And
yeah.
Those were great days, and Tommy always had my back, him and Ed Jubenville, when he was still alive from Massachusetts. They were just great, great, great people in my life.
Mike, there was another story, and I think I told you about this the first time we talked on the phone. There was a book called Arnold Schwarzenegger Conversations, and they talked about a story with you and Arnold at the grocery store, and you bought a rump roast for a dinner or a barbecue or something. Tell that story, if you would.
Oh, man, you know, these are all great things for my autobiography, but, you know, I might as well give a sneak preview. Then people might say, why don't you write a book? Because I've got a million stories.
Yeah.
But, and some of them are really, really personal. That one wasn't that personal in a way, because, I mean, how personal can it be when you're in a supermarket?
Right.
Arnold had a roast beef, you know, with the strings around it. And
right.
Had it, you know, the fat cut off. It was probably about 12 pounds, like a shot put. And there was a line, this is at Santa Monica at a supermarket. There's probably about 12 people in line waiting to get checked out, and they weren't opening up any other registers. So Arnold said, I don't have any time for this. You know, he shot puts the rump roast, the pot roast or whatever, over 12 people. And it splashed down on the conveyor belt. Everybody turns around and they look up, and they say, Arnold, and Arnold said, is there a problem? 22-inch arms are hanging out, and, you know, everybody's probably on weed anyways back then, or even now, and no, man, no, it's no problem. I know you're in a rush, and I go on. If you were in New York and you did that, there would have been 12 guns or 12 knives out. You wouldn't have lasted 2 feet to the cash. If you ever did that in New York City. California, you know, is like laid back and he got away with it.
So right.
That was funny.
And then I heard another story where you were at Arnold's apartment and you guys were getting to get to go train at Gold's Gym, and he got a letter in the mail, and it had a picture of Sergio with his arm, like, bigger than his head, and Arnold was, like, speechless for a second.
Yeah, I'll never forget that, you know, and that was, you know, I think Sergio, in a way, kind of deserved that I'm tired, let's rest, when he psyched Sergio off the stage. I think Arnold remembered that photo, you know, because that was Sergio's way of, I mean, Sergio had a freakish body. I mean, Arnold was gorgeous, you know, like a, you know, just a much bigger version of Frank Zane or, I'm trying to think of the other one, who, a Flex Wheeler, who, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate. I love Flex, and a Flex, I'm not demeaning Flex, I'm trying to give him an applause. If Flex had my motivation, he never would have been beaten.
Right.
He would be 30 times Mr. Olympia.
Right.
That's the kind of body, that beautiful body that Flex had. That's what Arnold had, but obviously much bigger.
Right.
And when I saw that, I'll never forget, I closed my eyes right now. It was in a manila envelope. It was like an 8x10 glossy, probably one that he signs when he autographs at posing exhibitions. And Arnold looked, and I saw his face just drop. I never saw Arnold that way. I never, ever saw Arnold that way. Although it's interesting, there is one picture also in Essen, in the Mr. Olympia. There's a picture of Sergio hitting the most muscular, turned towards Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
And Arnold's face was on the floor, looking at Arnie and Arnold, that Sergio with that muscular. So those are the only two times I ever saw Arnold sort of be human and understand that somebody is psyching you out. And is, when I tell you, John, Sergio, you had, now whether Sergio had a tiny pea head, I don't know. It's, but symmetrically, maybe his head was that much smaller, but I want to give him credit. His arms, it was a front double bicep. Each arm, each delt, and each pec. So now we got arms, delts, and pecs. Every one of those body parts dwarfed his head. You're looking at him and go, what the F? How am I going to do this?
Right.
It was, That's another story that's going in the book.
Yeah. Did he sign it? Did Sergio sign it and say, see you at the Olympia?
Yeah, he did. He said, see you, Arnold. See you at the Olympia.
Right.
So did I tell you that or did somebody else tell you?
I read that in a magazine somewhere.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I just wanted to see if it was true.
Yeah, there's not too many secrets out there, although there are some. And I'm going to save them for the book. If not, there won't be anything unique. It'll just be a ramblings of what's already happened.
Right. Let's talk about the book, Pumping Iron, Mike, because you didn't know Charles Gaines or George Butler when they came along and they wanted to write a book. And I thought that was a really well-done book, and especially talking about the trip that you and Ed Corney took to Baghdad, Iraq, and competing in the Mr. Universe contest there. I thought they did a really good job with that, don't you?
Yeah, the book was great, and that's why they were able to get the backing for the movie,
mm-hmm.
because the book had been so well done. Yeah, that was interesting. I mean, I got off the plane and went through customs in Iraq, you know, and had the Jewish last name, and they took my passport. My father couldn't believe it when I got back. I mean, he says, you never allow a country to take your passport and then give it to you when you leave the country. But I said, what am I going to do? I mean, I'm 20-something years old. They tell you to give their passport. The American officials, Weider was there, so forth. And, I mean, what was I going to do? Get back on a freaking plane and try to go back to America? So, but I mean, the Arab people loved me. You could see the picture of that little boy with the bathrobe looking striped. They call it the marketplace. It's called a souk.
Mm-hmm.
The souk in Iraq is a marketplace. And the little boys are running along. They're looking up with a
mm-hmm.
thing in their
mm-hmm.
And our escort from Iraq, God bless him, what a wonderful guy. You can see him with me, kind of following us around. And all we ate was kebabs. And the word shish kebab comes from what they call a kebab,
right?
Which is meat and vegetables on a stick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was all that we ate the entire time. Give us 30 kebabs, and we'd take some of the vegetables off and just eat the meat while we were there. I remember what was amazing is, you know, they had this, like, royal party for, like, the heads of government in Iraq and all these dignitaries, and everybody was dressed up, and there was this fish. You know, it was a buffet, like a dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Outside, and it was a fish that had to be like 300-pound fish, and it, you know, and this was going to be part of the film. All of a sudden, after the dignitary said what they had to say, it was like a little dinner bell that rang, and people died. I'd say within, it was like piranha. Within 3 minutes, the fish was right down to the freaking bone.
Wow.
But I told Corny, I said, let's get the hell out of here before they think about eating us. Let's go get a couple of kebabs, because I'm not fighting in the middle of these crazy people eating the food like they never ate before.
And it looked like when you guys were walking down the street that crowds of people would follow you, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we were not only Americans, which is different. There's very few Americans that were there. And we were big, huge guys, like two times, three times bigger than they were.
Yeah.
And they knew the cameras were going, so they knew we were something important. And they had advertised the fact that, you know, the world championship, Mr. Universe, was going to be in Baghdad. So, you know, we were kind of like famous people that came to the country.
Right, right. Hey, what'd you think of Louis Ferrigno when you first, because you competed with him when he won his first Mr. Universe, right? Or was it second Mr. Universe
in
Italy?
In Switzerland, I think.
Yeah.
That was one of the first times. I think Waller was second and I was third.
Right.
Yeah, Louis was, you know what's interesting, and this is nothing against anybody. I mean, I can tell you easily, have no problem telling you, you know, that I have long legs, and my long legs may help make me a very fast runner. But in trying to be a 20-inch calf kind of guy and also run a 4.640 with full pads with the New York Jets, I wasn't blocky. You know,
yeah.
You look at Waller. Waller's got shorter thighs. They're rounder. He's got better calves. You know, my calves weren't good. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I really did pretty damn good for, A, not having calf implants like maybe somebody else did. You know who. But I won't mention that. That's for the book.
Okay.
You know, and I wonder to myself, why doesn't this guy, what's his name, the German guy, you know, from Germany in the Mr. Olympia with the blonde hair?
Oh, Dennis Wolf.
Huh?
Dennis Wolf.
Yeah, what is, you know, now when Louis, you know, had some cosmetic surgery, it was like maybe 30-inch calves.
Yeah.
That weren't really real.
Right.
So, you know, why don't you go to 22 so that, you know, you can kind of slide by.
Right.
And I just, you know, I just wonder to myself, and I'm not even wondering as a judge, I'm just wondering as like a Dennis Wolf fan.
Mm-hmm.
And why doesn't, you know, he do something about that?
Yeah.
He went all this money. Now, you don't have to be, I mean, if somebody's got a crooked nose and crooked teeth and flat-chested or whatever, you get a little surgery.
Right.
It's just cosmetic. And that's the only thing you can really say about Dennis Wolf that's wrong.
Yeah.
You get down below the knee, and that doesn't make sense.
Right.
I think I'm better. As bad as I was below the knee, I think I'm better than he is.
Right.
So, whatever, you know, people make their own decisions in life, do what they want to do, and, you know, you can write two articles on how I improve my calves and cross your fingers, writing a great article on new exercise that you found to get your calves. I mean, people will believe.
Right.
You know? But just don't go to, like, Louis, don't go to, like, 30 inches or something, you know, because that's
right.
Too much.
Right, right. Hey, let's talk about the 81 Olympia, Mike, because that was the one that Franco won. And I read in stories in the magazines that after the 1980 Mr. Olympia in Australia, Arnold was sort of worried that there wasn't going to be so many people boycotting that show and that he asked you and guys like Ken Waller to personally to go into the show because he was worried that there wasn't going to be enough people in it?
You know, I can't say that, John, because he never, you know, either I was kind of naive to realize that, but I never had any conversations. Mm-hmm. I wanted Waller. I wanted to go in drug-free, so I didn't know. I wouldn't have cared if three people showed up, and Arnold or Jim Lorimer never called me or ever asked me, because I was going in, come hell or high water. I didn't care who was there.
Right.
Now, did we, you know, as a group, help improve the group of competitors? Sure. You know, I have my fans, and maybe they would have gone even if I didn't compete, and Waller maybe as well. But, you know, we had a good group of people there, and it was a good contest. And, you know, somebody had to wait another year before they got a chance to win. I'm not saying anything, but...
Who is the most impressive Mr. Olympia winner, Mike? Who do you think, out of all the years in the Mr. Olympia history, was the most impressive Mr. Olympia winner?
Gee, you know, I can look at... You know, I can. It's like, who's the best baseball player? You know, like, you know, who was the best home run hitter? Barry Bonds, Babe Ruth, Sammy Sosa, whatever. Ty Cobb in baseball, and, you know, Joe Montana in football. It's really hard to say. I'm a big guy, so would I like big guys, you know, to win? I'm not perfect, and some guys who really weren't perfect, you know, one like me, but were just bigger and better than I was.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at Dorian Yates, and he had flaws. And you look at, you know, Jay Cutler, and he had flaws with his hips being wide. And then you look, you know, but they were great Mr. Olympias. I would say, and again, I'd have to, hopefully I don't rethink it where I want to change the answer after we're done, but maybe I'll get a chance to. When I think about it more. But, I mean, Arnold's got to be in there.
Yeah.
You know, no question. I mean, Lee Haney is one of the greatest human beings I've ever met. His personality, his being, his soul is better than his body. And his body, in its peak, was one of the greatest of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So for me to say to you that, and I love Bill Pearl, I love him today. I talk with Dave Draper all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Lee Haney is, you know, I don't know, there's just some gleam in his eye. If you ever met him, it would be like you had met him your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
He's so approachable and such a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to leave out other people because some of the nicest people I've ever met. But, you know, when you say a standout of a person in the body, it's Lee Haney.
Yeah.
But, again, you've got to include the kid who's Mr. Olympia now.
Phil Heath.
You know, Heath is Flex Wheeler reborn and 30% bigger.
Yeah.
So that's how, if you said, okay, explain Heath, he's Flex, but 30% more blown up than Flex, bigger, thicker, better. But that beauty of a body, Heath is beating some freaks.
Yeah.
And who he's not as big as, but he's got a beautiful body. I think somebody will come along who'll be better.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who or where, but I think, you know, Heath has got to lose himself now.
Yeah.
Because he's himself out in front and beating everybody in their best shape. So, you know, is he going to get better? Can he get better? Can he stay the same? Obviously, if he can stay the same and everybody else doesn't get better,
yeah,
then, you know, it seems hard for him, you know, to lose.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean he's going to win.
Yeah.
He's got to go out there and prove that he could perform like he did the last 3 years.
Yeah. And Mike, what'd you think?
I have to run. I'd love to continue this. I've got to get a carpal surgery little thing done on my wrist so I can feel my fingers again.
Okay.
But boy, you know, if my fans out there and the people who listen to the show at some time want me to come back and they have a list of questions that they would like to ask. It would be fun to do it again.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it, and the time really just sped by.
Yeah, it did. All right, Mike Katz, well, thank you very much for joining us, and we really appreciate your stories from the golden age of bodybuilding. We think you're one of the icons in the sport, and we'll always remember you from the book and the movie Pumping Iron. So thank you very much for your time, Mike. I know you're a busy guy, and we appreciate you joining us on the Bodybuilding Legend Show.
It's my pleasure, and hope to have a chance to talk with you again. Thanks for doing such a great job, John.
All right, Mike. Thank you very much.
Take care.
All right, thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. I want to thank our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring this episode. And as I said, please go to iTunes and leave a review of the show when you get a chance. And send me any emails you have to naturalolympia@gmail.com. And if you're interested in ordering any of my books, including the Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends Volume 1 or the MP6 Workout or my brand new one, Diary of a Natural Bodybuilder, you can email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com or just go to amazon.com and purchase them there. All right, everybody, have a great week. We will see you next week with our interview with Manuel Perry. Take care.